more song to go and then the show's over. But I will be back next week, 4 o'clock Wednesday afternoons, 4 until 5:30. The show's called At Large. I just want to say thank you so much for listening today. I really appreciate it. And I, as you know, I usually end, not always, but most of the time I end with a Manitoba or a Winnipeg band. Today it won't be, but strong connections to Winnipeg, and they will be appearing live here next February. So I hope you enjoy it. The show's called At Large. It's 101.5 UMFM.
Against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
I teach my children about systemic racism and about historic and persistent colonialism and the responsibility that comes with their privilege. I will use my voice to speak up, and I will make more space at the table.
I will continue to educate myself and others in my community about the racism and inequities faced by BIPOC.
We will not be silent and idle.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba.
Our guest this evening is New Mexico-based painter Moka Leger, born in North Africa, renowned for her signature-shaped canvas paintings, exploring hypothetical space and light through large, colorful, geometric abstractions. Moka graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Painting from the Corcoran College of Art and Design in Washington, D.C., where she studied under several prominent members of the Washington Color School. In addition to her painting practice, Moka has worked as an independent and guest curator, art restorer, arts writer, and was assistant at the New Mexico Museum of Fine Arts. In theater, she has worked as a set designer, scriptwriter, actor, and director. She has also received a degree from Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service and travels widely as a French interpreter and translator. Her work has been shown in numerous national and international solo and group exhibitions, and her pieces may be found in many museum, public, private, and corporate collections. Moka lives and works in a studio in the mountains near Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You're an accomplished painter, renowned for your innovative, brilliantly colored geometric abstractions. Would you like to share a few of your early memories of what drew you to becoming an artist?
I'm thinking about talking a little bit about how geometric abstraction has been an influence from very early on, because growing up in North Africa, geometric patterns were everywhere, from Roman mosaics to Berber designs and Native American designs, which oddly have a reflection to Berber designs as well. But the interesting thing about all of that is that women were the weavers and geometric pattern makers, so for baskets and rugs, and that required a lot of good math skills. So that was maybe an early influence, although it took me a while to process it. But North Africa definitely was and still is a strong influence, just like New Mexico. It's no surprise that I'm here. Both are desert geographies. which I love because of the sheer spaciousness, both geographical and mental. There's a lot that you can take in internally and externally with that. So North Africa being full of these geometric patterns, I think did have a strong effect on me. And in fact, some of my earliest work was influenced by Islamic art and patterns. So I grew up in this very multicultural context with multiple languages, different skin colors, different clothing, and human difference just seemed very normal to me and very open. And it was only when I went back to Europe and the States that I got a sense that societies were much more monolithic. And there I started to feel a little displaced. So basically, I think that some of the work that I do having to do with visual displacements goes back to this whole idea of geographical displacement.
And can you tell us a bit more about your formal training and experience at the Corcoran College of Art and some of the artists or schools of thought that were influential early in your career?
So the Corcoran School of Art was an interesting, forward-looking school at the time, I would say. I happened to be living in D.C. for a number of reasons at the time, and I enrolled there not really knowing what I wanted to specialize in. I tried printmaking, painting, sculpture, ceramics, and I was really caught up with the photo department. I realized that this was the best way to train my eye, both in composition and powers of observation. And it remains to this day a very much lifelong pursuit. My first teacher at the Corcoran was Paul Reed, who was an older member of the Washington Color School. And he was focused on teaching color, complementaries and tertiaries and shade value, et cetera. And one day he said, you know, Mocha, you've got color in your pocket. You own that. And it was just such an encouragement because I felt it, but I had never had somebody with that authority tell me as a teenager. As a result, or maybe one thing led to another, I also met Jean Davis, who was a prominent member of the Color School Painters, and we became friends. One day he asked me to come and try out as studio assistant, and we got along very well. I was supposed to replace him for the summer, and I ended up staying 4 years. And it was an amazing experience because he trusted me with the very critical aspects of his paintings with virtually no supervision. And we were completely in sync in our understanding and rhythm of color and the playfulness. So that lasted for 4 years. And then he died suddenly, unfortunately. But I had learned the importance of discipline to be a successful artist. After he died, I was called in to help to inventory his studio. And that was a great insight into the importance of preserving a legacy, one that I'm actually working on my own at this point. There are too many people really to mention who were influential. I would say the women teaching at the Corcoran were strong feminists. They had a tag team teaching system whereby there were no male teams or female teams. It was always one of each. The instructors would never talk about their own work so that the students would not be influenced. But the women teachers, as women artists at the time, were underpaid and still less than these males with all of the egalitarian approach. So this was something I became aware also. Jean Davis certainly had a coterie of male artists and was recognized by many male curators. And so it's a heavily male-dominated environment. Women, of course, we know were not represented in museums nearly as much as men. So that aspect was something I was aware of, not quite ready to act on or know how to or what to do with it. But interestingly, two of these teachers, decades later, have recently come to visit in Santa Fe. So I find that really wonderful to have kept this long arc of history, including with Paul Reed, who died, I think, at the age of 96 a few years back. And we had stayed in touch the whole time. So these are important relationships that you make. Many, many of the people that I had met there stayed in my orbit.
And talk about, you have lived in regions with radiant light and dramatic geographical contexts. How have these elements played a significant role in your practice and artworks through your career? And maybe give us a few examples of some pieces particularly reflective.
One of the reasons I'm in New Mexico, I mentioned it, is because it was so resonant with North Africa where I grew up. And in the mid-90s, I was on a trip related to an interpreting project, which brought me here. And it felt so much like North Africa. I once again had the sense that I needed to move here. Fast forward to my early 30s, and I began the whole process of leaving DC to move here. One weekend, I was driving around looking at property, realizing I wouldn't be able to afford anything in town. I got further and further out, and lo and behold, I discovered a property on top of a mountain that had no well, no electricity, no road to speak of, and no flat building site, and I bought it. It was 20 acres of land on top of a mountain. And I'm still here today, I should add. I built a solar home and solar studio. So all of this to say the importance of space and color and light was so powerful as an existential reality that I had to move here. Now, in New Mexico, of course, there's a history of tradition of artists working with space and color and light, notably the Transcendental Painting Group, settled in the 40s, and many others who have been influenced by the color, Agnes Martin, the other light artists, too numerous to mention. This area also attracted artists from Europe and from other places in the U.S. I would also add that I was deeply moved by Native American traditions and their paintings, their way of being, their respect and relationship with the land. And I mentioned relationship because ultimately, I think this goes back to my shaped canvases and my work in general, that it has to do with the relationship, with navigating relationships, which we do from the moment that we're born between our parents and our environment. But the particular kind of relationship with the land here is something unique that I felt I needed to be a part of. As far as particular works, I would say all of my paintings are connected to some degree with this idea of space and color. And I could cite maybe some of the works in the Skybox series. So the Skybox series, I started about 15 years ago, and it was based on a memory that I had when I was 6 or 7 years old, riding in the back of the family car and looking at the sky from the rear windshield. And I would experience such vertigo as if falling into the sky from this glass box. It was very exhilarating and terrifying at the same time. And this experience of total perceptual instability is something that really stayed with me. It was a bit like seeing my first mirage in the Sahara Desert. So this idea of optical truth is something that grew. Of course, I wasn't articulating as a six-year-old, but that stayed with me, and as an artist that I was interested in exploring. The Mahdi Museum, where I had a show in 2016, was an interesting development because the Mahdi movement has never really been fully recognized in the U.S., I would say, although it's alluded to, it's mentioned. Recently, I was at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, and there's an entire wing that's been rehung with quite a bit of geometric abstraction, kinetic art, and a small glass case devoted to Mahdi. But it almost seems, I'm not quite sure why, that it's a hyphen or a comma in many of these movements, potentially because it's not a purely American-born movement. But the interesting thing is it got me looking at many of the sources of Mahdi. And Mahdi, I should say, M-A-D-I, ostensibly stands for Movement, Abstraction, Dimension, Invention. And the works were generally geometric, irregular, maybe kinetic, three-dimensional. This is a movement that started in Latin America. Carmelo Arden Quinn was the founder in Argentina, and he left during the political strife there and settled in Paris and spread his ideas about the movement. And Mahdi today, Mahdi art and the Mahdi movement is still alive, which is quite extraordinary, although it's not coherent as a movement, but Mahdi practitioners still exist in France and Hungary and Italy, and I would guess in Latin America as well. The Latin American artists, I felt, were very much ahead of the concrete art movement, which had started with the Bauhaus and did not develop in the same way in the States at all. In the US, we had minimalism, we had reductive art, conceptual art, but nothing really specifically like concrete and neo-concrete and Mahdi art. So my interest with the museum was to learn more about them. I met the owners who were the original collectors who had gone to Paris and started collecting the Mahdi artists. And they invited me to do a solo show in 2016, which I was delighted to, and discovered their entire collection. It was phenomenal. And one thing led to another, and I was invited as a curator at large for the museum. So I was able to bring some artists from France, which is where I'm from. In particular, I was keen on doing a show of the women in their collection, women abstractionists, because there is, to this day, I would say, very few women working in the traditionally male idiom of geometric abstraction. But that's my history with the museum. And unfortunately, they are now closed permanently. The collection has been dispersed, unfortunately, as well. Although I think there is a core group that might still be in there. But Mahdi is struggling in the US, I would say. But historically, I still believe it remains an important movement. And to wit, the Met Breuer had a show of Ligia Papa, I believe, and Ligia Clark at the MoMA a few years back. So it's on the radar. It's just not purely American.
You've also worked with and experimented with a variety of materials. Do you want to elaborate on a few examples?
I've worked with a number of materials, especially early on. I was testing all kinds of media, from molding paste to bird seeds to lacquer to quite a bit of collage and mixed media collage. And when I went to the Corcoran, I was coming in part from a European background and North African background, but also from a kind of nomadic life where we had traveled quite a bit. And my father, when I was 18, was living in Japan. I had a chance to go and visit him. And that was a very significant opening for me in terms of learning about reductive art and essentialism, but also Buddhism, which is a practice that I still maintain. So that was a beginning for me. And I got into the lacquer work that way, which began a pure depth essentialist kind of work. At the Corcoran, I was experimenting with all kinds of things. And as I mentioned, photography was so critical as far as a compositional tool and an eye training tool, which I still use to this day. My photographs are extremely important as source material, as is art history. But for the last more than 15 years, and even before then, I worked with modular type paintings. The more recent, well, I'd say 15, 20 years, which have been essentially shaped canvases, are purely painted works. So the shaped canvas has a long history, but to my mind, it was an unfinished history. To some degree, because it was the hegemony of the male practice, male idiom for one. And for another, during that period, many of the practitioners were under the dictates of Clement Greenberg, who was the prominent art critic at the time. And so even the male artists were constrained to some degree to avoid illusionism and texture and so on and so forth, to create large fields and formalistic works. My initial sense was, well, what would have happened if they had gone the complete other way? And I would argue that Stella began doing that with his Polish Village series, but then veered off into other types of sculptural work. So this was something that I was interested in, and using the shaped canvas on the one hand to disrupt the traditional orthogonal frame, to create irregular perimeters, and at the same time to create shifting perspectives within the canvas and within the shapes and the colors, because that is how we experience the world, through shifting perspective, through ambiguity, through these perceptual instabilities. And I began to explore this, which, again, if you look at the long arc of my work, started when I was experiencing these perceptual displacement shifts as this multicultural nomadic kid. So I felt there was unfinished work in that particular field. And yes, the Washington Color School was influential in the sense that I'm still painting on canvas. It's not raw, because I do put a primer just for archival purposes. And there are very few women practitioners, I think, doing this kind of work. I'm absolutely passionate about it. And here again, the color, the space has to do with the relationship, and the ambiguity has to do with addressing the viewer, caring, taking care of the viewer, and engaging the viewer. This is not about, I'm plopping a piece of work and, you know, you figure it out. So maybe this relational approach, a relational aesthetic of sorts, is a more feminine approach. I'm not sure, but it is something that I take to heart. There is an engagement between the eye and the brain and the heart that occurs with the work, but cannot happen without the viewer in that sense.
As a set designer and scriptwriter-director, how did you adapt your work, and perhaps describe a few of the set designs or projects that you may have done?
The set designing came about in a fortuitous way, because I was a young artist in Washington, D.C. I was looking to make a little bit of money to supplement meager sales, like most artists at the time. And there was a theater group, French theater group, that had been operating in the city for a while. I met a few of the actors, and one thing led to another. I was invited to do some sets. The first set that I did was a very large Art Deco set, and I loved it. It was, of course, right up my alley. And one thing led to another. I began acting with the troupe, and then discovered other troupes, moved on, and began doing happenings, improv performances. It was a very lively time. What it taught me is the importance of choreography in your work, in your approach, in composition, in relations with others. It was very exciting. And I would say, fast forward to the present, it's something that has been a factor for my performance work with the visual scores to a large degree.
Is that the kind of work that you did with the Chicago Symphony and the Chamber Series?
So about 5 years ago, I began working with visual scores. More recently, I've been animating these drawings and paintings and having them performed by musicians. I'm also working with collaborators. So this is a new area for me in terms of a more collaborative approach. But the visual scores began as drawings. They're actually pastel on paper. They're drawn very often in silence, although I have an internal music often, or soundscape, I would say. It's something that's an imaginary music, much like some of my early work, which had to do with imaginary scripts and writings and mark making. So it transcends place, or it englobes places, a universality to music, obviously, that transcends cultures to some degree. But the works themselves were both standalone drawings as well as scores to be performed. The collaboration began after a residency that I did during COVID. I met a young composer by the name of Bobby G, who saw my works there, and I listened to his music. We both hit it off and decided we wanted to do a collaboration. That's what led to the performance at the Chicago Civic Orchestra with the symphony. And there are other projects that we are collaborating in, and I have other collaborators now. So it's, again, a very exciting part of my practice now. In last May, I was awarded a residency at the New Mexico Museum of Art. It was an inaugural residency with the Vladim Contemporary Museum. And that gave me a chance to do three performance works based on the animated visual scores. With my collaborator, Morgan Barnard, we created these projections, which were then interpreted by musicians, some classically trained, some untrained. The only thing they had to do was to respond immediately or live to the piece that was being projected and to each other. Some brought bags of sands and sonic instruments. Others had traditional violins. And we recorded all of these in three very different venues, including in a dome where their shapes were completely stretched out. The drawings were the basis of many of them, but some of the paintings as well, including a pivotal piece that I had created in Morocco when I was on another residency. And this piece was based on the architecture of a northern Moroccan town where the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim architectures were completely enmeshed. And for thousands of years, these people had been transacting and living together. And I was very attracted by the architecture and the shapes, and of course, the way the light creates a different architecture of shadows. The piece that I created there was about 9 feet long, and that was the basis for the Chicago interpretation piece. So many residencies have gone through this work.
Can you tell us what's next for you? And do you have any upcoming exhibitions or series you're working on that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I've just been through a period of extremely busy projects and performances, exhibitions. And at this point, I need a little time to pull back, which is great because I have about a year before my next major exhibition. I liken some of this creative process to a sponge. There's a period where you really have to absorb as much as you can, and there's a period for expressing the sponge and all the juices that come out of that. So the absorption has to do with research and following these remote ideas or specks of intuition, which is challenging because, as Paul Reed once told me, there are a lot of artists who will jump to every single idea and do a lot of things with that. But I think what happens over time is you become more discriminating and you make tougher decisions about a trajectory you're going to follow. It's what Richard Serra called An Idea with a Future. So that's where I'm going.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your story and valuable insight with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.
As a part of their ongoing fall concert series, the Winnipeg Folk Festival is pleased to welcome the dynamic duo of Danny Michelle and Steve Poltz to the West End Cultural Center for one night only on Tuesday, November 19th. After meeting at a folk festival nearly a dozen years ago, Danny and Steve are the best of pals now and are happily reuniting for a captivating performance that promises to blend their distinctive songs and stories into an unforgettable experience. Concert goers are sure to be treated to an evening filled with playful energy, musical mischief, and spontaneous collaborations. Tickets for this entertaining night of music start at only $35 plus fees, available now through Ticketmaster. Don't miss Danny Michelle and Steve Poltz at the West End on Tuesday, November 19th, proudly supported by UMFM 101.5.
Oh, radio. What? No.
You're listening to CJUM FM 101.5, broadcasting from the University of Manitoba at 1200 watts.
Radio.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Stop the things you do. What's up? I ain't lying. Yeah, I can't stand. Woo! No running around. I can't stand. No putting me down. I put a spell on you. What's up? I love.